We waited. There was no conversation. There wasn't much air in the truck. The weather was warm again. Frasconi released the Syrian after 40 minutes. He came strolling into view from the north. He had been warned what would happen if he gave us away. Cole had written the script, and Frasconi had delivered it. They were threats we probably wouldn't have carried out, but he didn't know that. I guess they were plausible, based on what happened to people in Syria. He sat down at a sidewalk table. He was 10 feet from us. He put his briefcase on the floor, level with the side of the table. It was like a second guest. The waiter came and took his order, came back after a minute with an espresso. The Syrian lit a cigarette, smoked it halfway down, and crushed it out in the ashtray.
"The Syrian is waiting,"
Cole said quietly. She had a tape recorder running. Her idea was to have a real-time audio record as a backup. She was wearing her dress greens, ready for the arrest. She looked real good in them.
"Check," the judge said. "The Syrian is waiting."
The Syrian finished his coffee and waved to the waiter for another. He lit another cigarette.
"Does he always smoke so much?" I asked.
"Why?"
"Is he warning Quinn off?"
"No, he always smokes," Cole said.
"Okay. But they're bound to have an abort sign."
"He won't use it. Frasconi really put a fright in him."
We waited. The Syrian finished his second cigarette. He put his hands flat on the table. He drummed his fingers. He looked okay. He looked like a guy waiting for another guy who was maybe a little overdue. He lit another cigarette.
"I don't like all this smoking," I said.
"Relax. He's always like this."
"Makes him look nervous. Quinn could pick up on it."
"It's normal. He's from the Middle East."
We waited. I watched the crowd build up. It was close to lunchtime.
"Now Quinn is approaching," Cole said.
"Check," the judge replied. "Quinn is approaching now."
I looked to the south. Saw a tidy-looking guy, neat and trim, maybe 6'1" and a little under 200 pounds. He looked a little younger than 40. He had black hair with a little gray in it in front of his ears. He was wearing a blue suit with a white shirt and a dull red tie. He looked just like everybody else in D.C. He moved fast, but he made it look slow. He was neat in his movements, clearly fit and athletic, almost certainly a jogger. He was carrying a Halliburton briefcase. It was the exact twin of the Syrian's. It flashed slightly gold in the sunlight. The Syrian laid his cigarette in the ashtray and sketched a wave. He looked a little uneasy, but I guess that was appropriate. Big-time espionage in the heart of your enemy's capital is not a game. Quinn saw him and moved toward him. The Syrian stood up, and they shook hands across the table. I smiled. They had a smart system going. It was a tableau so familiar in Georgetown that it was almost invisible. An American in a suit, shaking hands with a foreigner across a table loaded with coffee cups and ashtrays. They both sat down. Quinn shuffled on his chair and got comfortable, and placed his briefcase tight alongside the one that was already there. At a casual glance, the two cases looked like one in a larger size.
"Briefcases are adjacent,"
Cole said into the microphone.
"Check," the judge said. "The briefcases are adjacent."
The waiter came back with the Syrian's second espresso. Quinn said something to the waiter and he left again. The Syrian said something to Quinn. Quinn smiled. It was a smile of pure control, pure satisfaction. The Syrian said something else. He was playing his part. He thought he was saving his life. Quinn craned his neck and looked for the waiter. The Syrian picked up his cigarette again and turned his head the other way and blew smoke directly at us. Then he put the cigarette out in the ashtray. The waiter came back with Quinn's drink, a large cup, probably white coffee. The Syrian sipped his espresso. Quinn drank his coffee. They didn't talk.
"They're nervous," Cole said.
"Excited," I said. "They're nearly through. This is the last meeting. The end is in sight for both of them. They just want to get it done."
"Watch the briefcases," Cole said.
"Watching them," the judge replied.
Quinn put his cup down on the saucer, scraped his chair back, reached forward with his right hand, picked up the Syrian's case.
"Quinn has the Syrian's case," the judge said. Quinn stood up, said one last thing, and turned around and walked away. There was a spring in his step. We watched him until he was out of sight. The Syrian was left with the check. He paid it and walked away north, until Frasconi stepped out of a doorway and took his arm and led him right back toward us. Cole opened up the truck's rear door, and Frasconi pushed the guy inside. We didn't have much space with five people in the truck.
"Open the case," the judge said. Up close, the Syrian looked a lot more nervous than he had through the glass. He was sweating, and he didn't smell too good.
He laid the case flat on the floor and squatted in front of it, glanced at each of us in turn, and clicked the catches and lifted the lid. The case was empty. I heard the phone ring inside the Xavier Export Company's office. The door was thick and heavy, and the sound was muffled and far away, but it was a phone, and it was ringing exactly 5 minutes after Duffy and Villanueva must have left the garage. It rang twice and was answered. I didn't hear any conversation. I guessed Duffy would make up some kind of a wrong number story. I guessed she would keep it going just long enough to look significant in a phone log. I gave it a minute. Nobody keeps a bogus call going longer than 60 seconds. I took the Beretta out of my pocket and pulled open the door, stepped inside into a wide, open reception area. There was dark wood and carpet, an office to the left, closed up, an office to the right, closed up, a reception desk in front of me, a person at the desk in the act of hanging up a phone. Not Quinn. It was a woman. She was maybe 30 years old. She had fair hair, blue eyes. In front of her was an acetate plaque in a wooden holder. It said, Emily Smith. Behind her was a coat rack. There was a raincoat on it, and a black cocktail dress, sheathed in dry cleaner's plastic, hanging on a wire hanger. I fumbled behind my back, left-handed, and locked the hallway door. Watched Emily Smith's eyes. They were staring straight at me. They didn't move. They didn't turn left or right toward either office door, so she was probably alone. And they didn't drop toward a purse or a desk drawer, so she was probably unarmed.
You're supposed to be dead.
Am I? She nodded, vaguely, like she couldn't process what she was seeing.
You're a reacher. Paulie told us he took you out.
I nodded. Okay, I'm a ghost. Don't touch the phone. I stepped forward and looked at her desk. No weapons on it. The phone was a complicated, multi-line console. It was all covered in buttons. I leaned down, left-handed, and ripped its cord out of its socket. Stand up. She stood up, just pushed her chair back and levered herself upright. Let's check the other rooms.
There's nobody here.
There was fear in her voice, so she was probably telling me the truth.